Well, we're going to switch gears now, and we're going to go to some policy and some Latin American issues, and we have our next guest on the line. My name is Steve. My co-host is Larry. This is 96.5 LPFM, Sarasota, Florida, WSLR.
All right, and this is Larry, and Jess Hunter Bowman is our guest. He's the Associate Director at Witness for Peace, is an expert on the role of U.S. policy in Latin America, although he lives currently in Indiana for the majority of the first decade of the new century. He was based in Colombia, following international relations and human rights in the field. He's been published widely in newspapers across the U.S., spoken on numerous panels, and written documents for policymakers on human rights, and particularly the situation in Colombia. 5.2 million internally displaced persons officially registered by Colombian Human Rights Group. Colombia is now host to the largest internal displacement crisis in the world. And our guest, Jess Hunter Bowman, lead us into this issue. How did Colombia, who we probably think of as having more of a problem about drugs, how did this displacement situation come about? It's huge.
It is, and thank you so much, Steve and Larry, for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. It is. It's astounding, and what's almost more astounding than the crisis itself is that people aren't aware of it. Colombia has been embroiled in a civil war for approximately 50 years now, and in the past 20 years, it's really kind of picked up speed and steam, and that's led to a major humanitarian crisis in the country. As you mentioned, 5.2 million internally displaced people in a country of only 45 million people. And this is a situation where you have left-wing guerrillas pitted against the Colombian security forces and right-wing paramilitary death squads. And, you know, as you see in many civil wars throughout the world, it's really the civilian population that bears the brunt of that. And just in the past 10 years, we've seen 30,000 civilians killed in this war and 3.3 million people internally displaced. These are internal refugees. These are people that are, they see family members killed. There's a massacre in their community. There's fighting between forces. And in order to save their lives, they flee and look for refuge in the jungle, in cities, and living in shacks, any way that they can to try to survive.
Well, Colombia is not a tiny country, but it's not massive either. Where do 5.2 million people get absorbed? I mean, it seems, help us visualize this. I'm used to understanding displacement as being the result of war or famine or migration of people of escaping dreadful horrors, but they usually go across a border or they are huddled in camps or something like that. What's the situation in Colombia?
Well, there are refugees that have crossed international borders in addition to these 5.2 million internal refugees. There's half a million that have fled Colombia's borders, but most have migrated within the country. And, you know, the case in Colombia is that these 5.2 million people are people that have been displaced since 1986, and some of them are currently still living in displacement camps. Some of them are, you know, have tried to create a new life for themselves in another part of the country. And frankly, though, others have returned to their homes. It's people that have fled at some point in time. Some of them have returned. Most of them have not. What people would imagine as displacement, refugee camps, that's not really the case in Colombia. There are at some points there's emergency camps like that where people will spend a couple of years, but the vast majority of these people are living, they basically move to the cities and are trying to find a new life, blend into society, in the slums on the outskirts of cities. And so you've seen the urban population in Colombia skyrocket in recent years as these people flee from the fighting in rural areas and move into the cities. And there's a real issue with, you know, people don't want to be in displacement camps for many of the obvious reasons, but also because of the fact that, you know, the war continues and people are afraid that they're going to be hunted down. And in fact, leaders of displaced communities are often tracked down and killed. And so people try to blend into society and try not to, you know, stand out as people who have faced this violence and are internally displaced people.
All right, so tell us why we here in the United States, why would be concerned about stuff going on in Colombia?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, beyond the obvious of that, you know, when there's human suffering going on in the world, it's something that should concern all of us. In the case of Colombia, we have a very special relationship with Colombia and the United States. One is that we consume 90% of the cocaine that's exported from Colombia, and that is a driving factor for this war because that drug money does fuel both the left-wing guerrillas and the right-wing paramilitaries. But more importantly, the U.S. government has gotten enmeshed in this conflict and has provided $6 billion in military assistance over the last decade to the Colombian security forces. And these are Colombian security forces that have the worst human rights record in the hemisphere. You know, we have documented cases from human rights groups in Colombia of 3,000 civilians killed at the hands of these security forces since 2002. And those are just documented cases. There's many, many more that go unreported.
Well, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. Well, I was just saying, we have here, not far from here, the School of the Americas, which is the torture school. And I think we've discussed that some of those people in Colombia were actually trained here in the United States, not far from here, just across Florida in Georgia, trained in those techniques that they're employing in Colombia. Have you heard anything about that?
Yeah, that's true. Approximately 20,000, I believe, soldiers from Colombia have been trained at the School of the Americas. Colombian soldiers have also been trained at Fort Bragg and other places, and there's U.S. Special Forces in Colombia that provide direct training there. But, of course, the School of the Americas is where the more Colombian soldiers have been trained there than anywhere else. And, of course, that is a very notorious school because, as you mentioned, we've gotten manuals released from the school that very explicitly taught torture there. And we've seen those, you know, there's a bloody track record across Latin America of students who have been trained at that school who have gone back to El Salvador and planned the killing of Archbishop Oscar Romero. There's the former head of the Colombian Armed Forces was trained at the School of the Americas as well, and he was the commander of a brigade in the large city of Medellin, he worked with paramilitaries to try to take over the slums in that city in a very bloody campaign. And so there's the notorious record of the School of the Americas, which is now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, is a very bloody record throughout the hemisphere. It continues today, and we have been advocating, along with many other groups, for many years to close down that school. It's long past time to do that.
Our guest is Jess Hunter Bowman, Associate Director of Witness for Peace, and Jess is talking to us about the issue of displacement of millions of people internally in Colombia. I wanted to go back to the origins of this problem. You say the Civil War has been going on for years, and of course Americans have, I think, a shameful history of supporting totalitarian regimes. Is that the kind of situation in Colombia? Who are the adversaries fighting the Civil War, and what are the stakes?
Well, you know, basically, as happens in many poor countries, I mean, it's come down to a question of who controls the land. When you have, you know, in a country like Colombia and many other developing countries, it's an agricultural-based economy oftentimes, especially for the poor. And so when you get to a question of who owns the land, who controls the land, and, you know, poor people who are able to have a small tract of land and farm are able to, you know, survive. Maybe they live in poverty, but they're not living in extreme poverty. And that's really the root of this conflict. I mean, there's some other complicating factors in Colombia around some political infighting that happened in the 40s and 50s. But basically, that's the main demand of the guerrillas, is to have land reform. It has been for a long time. But, you know, and when you mix into this conflict the question of drugs, one, it heightens the impact of the conflict because the warring factions have basically an unlimited supply of money from the money that they're able to tax off the drug trade or their direct participation in the drug trade. So it allows them to arm themselves, to, you know, recruit soldiers more easily for their ranks. But it also creates a situation in which it's a corrupting force. The guerrillas in Colombia are no, you know, starry revolutionaries. They're really, you know, have bloody tactics. They attack the civilian population. They're basically carrying out a military war to try to overthrow the Colombian government, and they'll kill anybody that stands in their way in their attempts to do that. And so, you know, there are political demands from the guerrillas. They're not drug trafficking. You know, they're not just dedicated to criminal activity and drug trafficking. They have a political agenda, but it's been corrupted quite a bit by the influence of drugs on them.
What kinds of policies do you see bringing this war to an end? I mean, it's been going on for so long. It sounds almost like an intractable problem.
Well, it certainly, you know, can look like that from the outside and from the inside, frankly. I mean, there's been many efforts towards peace negotiations that haven't borne fruit. I think one of the problems that we have in Colombia is that, you know, the U.S. government basically came in 1999 and 2000 and tried to apply what they'd called the El Salvador model to Colombia, which was, you know, in the civil wars in El Salvador, they sent in military assistance and trainers trying to prop up the El Salvadoran military, give them an edge enough so that they could weaken the guerrillas sufficiently that the guerrillas would sit down at the negotiating table and basically negotiate their surrender, which worked in El Salvador. And that's been the model that they've used in Colombia. And, you know, it has borne some fruit. The guerrillas are on their heels a bit. The Colombian government has been able to secure more areas of territory. But because of the strength of the Colombian guerrillas, I mean, this is the El Salvadorian guerrillas really pale in comparison to the guerrillas in Colombia. You're talking about a fighting force at its height of about 20, 25,000. Today it's probably more around 8,000 to 10,000, but still a hefty army with well funded by the drug trade. And you're just not going to get them to negotiate their surrender. You're not going to weaken them sufficiently to do that. And so what you've got is the U.S. assistance is convincing the Colombian military that they can defeat the guerrillas militarily, which is not going to happen. There's no military victory that's going to happen in Colombia. And what we need from the United States is a change of stance, of recognizing that, you know, all we're doing is, by providing military assistance, we're just prolonging this conflict. More people are going to die the longer this conflict goes on. And so what we'd like to see is a shift in U.S. policy. One, in terms of diplomacy, the shift should be towards helping the Colombian government negotiate a peaceful end to this conflict. A peaceful end to the conflict that includes civil society representatives at the negotiating table so that it's not just warring factions talking about how they want to divide up power and divide up the country, but there's civil society representatives there as well discussing that. And then shifting our assistance, we're providing all this military assistance while there's people suffering, as we talked about, 5.2 million people internally displaced. There's a human rights crisis. Our money could be better spent helping impoverished people, helping refugees get their lives back together and get reestablished in their homes and farm. And that's what we think that we should do, have a diplomatic policy that focuses on peace and an assistance policy that focuses on humanitarian assistance, alternative development, and human rights.
Tell us a little bit, again, our guest is Jess Hunter Bowman, Associate Director of Witness for Peace. Tell us a little bit about Witness for Peace, your organization, and what you're involved in now.
Sure. Witness for Peace is a 30-year-old grassroots organization. We have 20,000 members across the United States, and our focus is monitoring the impacts of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America with an eye towards promoting policies that support peace, justice, and sustainable economies in the Americas. And we have 6 regional offices throughout the United States where we organize people, get people involved, educate people about what are the impacts of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, and encourage them to engage with their representatives in Washington to forward policies that are more in line with their values.
Are you a religious organization?
We call ourselves faith and conscience based. The organization was born out of the faith movement, but right now we have people of all shades and stripes in our organization.
And what are you folks doing now to bring raise the awareness of the American people to this situation in Colombia?
Well, currently we're involved in a campaign called the National Days of Action for Colombia. We've got hundreds of congregations, local student groups, local community organizations that are involved, that are reading a bit about Colombia, learning about Colombia, and writing to their members of Congress about the situation in Colombia, and also creating what we're calling banners for peace, that people are writing messages of peace for communities in Colombia, communities at risk, that whose lives are at risk because they're standing up for peace and justice in that country, and then we're sending them down to those communities so that they know that they don't stand alone, that there's people in this country that care about them. And that's something that, that folks can get involved with. If they go to our website, they can find all the information about that.
We've had some people from WSLR in this community go up to protest to the School of the Americas, and that's something that's been done pretty much every year. And we did get a response from the government. They changed the name.
Exactly. Yep, they did. According to the government, they closed down the School of the Americas, and they put another one in the same place with the same classrooms with the same instructors.
But a different name. Is it dangerous for North Americans to be in Colombia? Are your people in your offices there at risk, or is it? Are there zones of safety that you can work in without being too cautious?
Well, you know, there's really two sides to that coin. One is that for people that go to Colombia, you know, it's a safe place to travel to. If you're going as a tourist to visit, it's a beautiful country. I have two daughters that were both born there, and we raised them there without concerns about their lives. You know, we took the simple precautions that, you know, anybody would take in a city in the United States. But when you're talking about getting engaged in peace and justice issues, when you're talking about going to visit communities that are affected by the war, that's something that people need to do carefully. We take delegations of people from the United States down to Colombia regularly. We send about 100 people a year, and they're able to go out into, you know, the conflict zones where there's not active conflict, but, you know, where there have been conflicts in the past, to meet with peace communities, to meet with churches that are in resistance. And, you know, we follow a very strict security protocol when we do that to ensure that people will be safe in doing that. I don't encourage people to try to go visit those communities on their own, because they'll put themselves at risk, and they'll also put the communities there at risk. But if you do it in a safe way with a group that knows what they're doing, then people are able to go visit without any problems.
The reason I ask is I have a friend whose sister and her husband living in Colombia, they're Colombians, were forced to send their young daughter to the United States to live with their aunt and uncle for fear that the family, who were landowners and business people there, felt like they were targets, and their own relatives had been targeted, and needed to feel that their young daughter was in a secure place, and sent up to the Boston area to go through grade school and finish her high school and college.
Yeah, then that's, unfortunately, it's the case for many Colombians, and, you know, until we come to a place of peace in Colombia, we're going to continue to face those issues. The situation for Colombians is quite a bit different from those of us that have a blue passport, and I could tell you stories about any number of friends of mine who have had, you know, people or community organizers in a rural part of Colombia who, you know, faced attacks and threats and were forced to flee and become internally displaced people, went into hiding in Bogota, were tracked down. One of my friends was shot in the leg, and we were finally able to get him into exile here in the United States. And unfortunately, you know, the situation for Colombians engaged in, you know, one, living in an area where there's conflict or outspoken advocates for peace, justice, and human rights will certainly face the effects of the war.
I want to turn back to policy for a minute here. And how does the free trade policy figure into what's going on in Colombia?
Well, I'm glad we got to talk about that, because that's really the hottest issue right now in Washington. People who follow Colombia in a marginal sense might have seen that just a couple weeks ago, the Colombian president was in Washington with Barack Obama, and they signed a quote-unquote action plan to try to move forward this pending free trade agreement. It does play a role. I mean, I don't want to drift into conspiracy theory here, but I do want to go a little bit deeper into this, because, you know, the only non-governmental representative that spoke during the debate about whether we should be providing $1 billion of military assistance to Colombia back in 1999 and 2000 was the vice president of Occidental Petroleum. And his concern was basically that the U.S. government provide this assistance, but make sure that they not only provide it in areas where there was where there are drug crops, but also where Occidental Petroleum had its operations. And certainly, you know, that bared fruit a couple of years later. In 2002, George W. Bush announced a $100 million military package to protect Occidental Petroleum's installations and their pipeline in Colombia. And so you certainly, there is U.S. economic interest in Colombia, and certainly every step that's made to drive the guerrillas further out of the cities and towns and areas where there's possibilities for mining operations, oil drilling operations, is a benefit to corporations and to U.S. corporations. And so certainly there's, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that a couple years after the Plan Colombia and this military assistance began, you saw negotiations begin for a free trade agreement. And today, that's, you know, where we stand is a pending agreement between U.S. and Colombia where, you know, the U.S. would have open market opportunities in Colombia, U.S. corporations would have those opportunities, and you'd see the consequences we've seen in other countries with free trade where U.S. cheap U.S. grain is exported to these countries. Farmers in those countries cannot compete because they don't have the kind of technological advances and whatnot that people have here in the United States. And small farmers go out of business. And I was just reading a study that showed that there'd be 400,000 farmers, small farmers in Colombia, who would lose between 50% and 70% of their income through this free trade agreement. And that leads to one of two things. Either these people become more internally displaced people, not displaced by the war, but displaced by economic policy, or those people turn to coca production, which is the raw material for cocaine, which goes completely counter to our stated policy goal, which is to dramatically reduce coca production in Colombia.
Lots of dilemmas there.
One other just quick policy. I'm sorry, we are running out of time, but I just want to bounce something, a very controversial issue of legalizing drugs to try to solve some of the problems here in the United States in terms of incarceration, since there's so many people of poor socioeconomic background who are being incarcerated, and how that would affect the situation in Colombia. And we just have about 30 seconds to go over that.
Okay, well, let me just say quickly, nobody wants, you know, there to be cocaine being sold in vending machines in schools across the United States. That's not what, you know, this debate is about. But I can tell you, all we need to do is turn on the news and look at what's going on in Mexico. You look at what's going on in Colombia, what's been going on there for the past 20 years. This policy has failed. Our drug war is a failure. If our goal was to try to reduce cocaine consumption and drug consumption in this country, to try to reduce the number of addicts in this country, it's been a complete failure. And we need to be talking about different things. And if that means opening up a can of worms and talking about some things that are controversial in some sectors, we need to talk about those things because these policies are failing completely, failing for us and failing for the people of Latin America.
Jess,
thank you so much.
Jess Hunter Bowman, and a website that people can turn to
witnessforpeace.org.
Witnessforpeace.org. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much to you too.